Yowza, yowza, yowza. Wigmaster here on the PLR Podcasts. And we're talking with a gentleman who I have just loved his stuff for several months now, even because that's when I was turned on to it. Adam Dunn, who has written Rivers of Gold, The Big Dogs, and Saint Underground. This is a book. Yeah, you remind me of Tom Clancy of finances. Because when you read Tom Clancy, you feel like you could probably put together a submarine from all the detail. And you are deep into elections and what do we call it? Underground banking?
Shadow banking.
Shadow banking. Now, when did you write this book, and did you foresee what we're living right now?
I don't have a crystal ball. My books are not predictions. All I do is just look at current events, extrapolate to what I think is the logical degree. Some people would say it's an extreme or absurd degree, but this book, when I started writing it in 2014, was the way I saw things going for the next presidential election. Due to the level of animosity between the parties and the amount of, or I should say, the way that both parties used populism as a political weapon to push their own agendas. And I simply looked ahead a couple of years out and thought this would be the level of toxicity that we would see in the next election cycle.
And it has indeed come true. Mm-hmm. One of the key things in this book that I had to put it down and go read the Dodd-Frank Act, because I thought I knew what it was, but you just portray it as exactly the exact opposite of what I thought it was.
And I don't believe they've actually finished writing it yet.
Well, it made my eyes glaze. Now, is that by design, do you think?
There was an old Broadway saying, if you can't amaze them with intelligence, then you baffle them with something I won't say on your podcast.
Well, you can say it on a podcast. That's a bit.
I think Dodd-Frank was rammed through Congress very much the same way another act of that particular Congress, known as ACA, when one of ACA's largest proponents said, if you want to know what's in it, you got to read it. So then make it several thousand pages long to ensure that people wouldn't.
And indeed, again, my eyes started to glaze, but I got the sense of just how heinous it was from reading this book. You have the shadow banking and your descriptions, the underground bank. I said to myself, this would make a great series. Definitely something HBO or maybe FX, where they do good, intense stories.
Well, hopefully we'll be going that route, and maybe we can talk about that a little later. But as far as the hole-in-the-ground theme, that did not come from nowhere. At the time I was writing this in 2014, work had finally, after almost a century, finally begun on the construction of the 2nd Avenue subway line in New York City. Now, they had been talking about this since at least the 1920s. And they finally got the hole dug, or they started digging. They brought in this giant boring machine from Sweden, I think it was. And they were boring it straight down 2nd Avenue. And they were so terrified that Al-Qaeda was going to hit the IRT, they would not let any local contractors bid on the job, which is how I connected with the unions who would otherwise have been involved with the Big Dig of New York, who were shut out of it. Instead, they gave it to, of all things, a foreign contractor. But
So they were worried about Al-Qaeda, but they gave it to a foreign contractor.
Never overestimate the intelligence of government.
Oh, my God.
So the hole, as it was being dug, went directly under Metropolitan Hospital in Manhattan, New York City. Metropolitan Hospital at the time had the largest inpatient bed count for mental health patients in the city. And as I was trying to get through the police cordon to get underground to see the tunnel, I was locked out, of course. I started talking to people at Metropolitan Hospital, at the mental health center, see about this. And my mind was cast back to the early 1980s when another asylum, I think it was called Greenwood or Greenhaven in Staten Island, was shut down. after a certain young Cup reporter named Geraldo Rivera aired an expose about the appalling conditions that the patients were subject to. And suddenly you had 1,500 or 2,000 homeless people turn loose on the streets of New York City because they shut it down without thinking what they were going to do with anybody. Those darn unforeseen consequences.
Yeah.
And it occurred to me that the very same thing could happen. Remember, this was back in 2010. We were still very much in the depths of the crisis and its after effects. What would happen if funding were cut to some place like Metropolitan Hospital's Mental Health Center, which had at the time, I think, 800 beds? 800 mentally ill people couldn't survive in the outside world. Where would they go?
Government.
Well, they would go straight down, and everyone is subject to one law on this planet, and that is gravity. They could literally go straight down out of their beds right into a hole in the ground, which is where I came up with the idea for the shadow bank being hidden behind the soup kitchen in the Second Avenue Subway.
Right, right. Brilliant. I am always just dazzled by talking to you. Now, you have the Odin group, all of the different factions coming around. I mean, how did you imagine that?
Odin is the single personification of a battlefield strategy that some ground commanders in Iraq came up with around about 05, 06. This is when they were fighting the insurgency full on. The American forces were taking terrible casualties. And there was a lot of strife between ground forces, particularly Army, and the Air Force, because the ground forces were facing IEDs and snipers. And you can't call in a supersonic jet fighter to check a road for IEDs from 1,000 feet up at 500 miles an hour. Doesn't work. And by the time they would place the call and get these guys in, well, the bad guys they were trying to get were long gone anyway. And you can't take out an IED with a B-52. It just doesn't work. So a couple of ground commanders in the Army decided to take matters into their own hands, and they began marshaling their own Army aviation units to coordinate with ground teams to be able to, at first, it was a protective idea, a sort of shield for ground forces, convoys moving in and around Baghdad and the Baghdad belts around the city. And it later sort of blossomed with the success of these coordinated air-to-ground units with a very, very high-tech level of surveillance capability in real time. They could pull emails out of the air. They could pull cell phone transmissions, faxes out of thin air. They had infrared cameras that could see through walls, or they had ground-penetrating radar that could see below pavements or roads. So they had much more real-time intelligence from the air that they could then give to the troops on the ground, which made the overall effort much more effective. And they called it Odin, for observation, detection, investigation, and neutralization. And it was such a success in Iraq that they stood up Odin units in Afghanistan, too, which I believe are still in operation. And all of this was not the result of some think tank or some generals in the rear. These were from frontline commanders based on actual battlefield conditions, responding to a situation as best they could, and it worked. And my character of Odin is the single embodiment of all of that improvisation into one character.
Now, you've got the banking industry. You've got Odin. Mm-hmm. You have the soup kitchens. Mm-hmm. How long did it take you to research all of this?
About 8 months.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
You devoted every hour to it?
As much as I possibly could. And I had several breakthroughs along the way, one of which was finally, and this was after over 2 years of trying, the unions in the city finally talked to me. Unions are rather clannish. They do not like talking to anybody they consider press. That includes book authors. But finally, after years of trying and trying to get into the Second Avenue subway line to focus on, it was because there was that tension between labor unions in the city, which would otherwise be involved with that project, and with the government kind of safety net that was thrown around it, that I think I was able to finally make contact with the people at the Transit Workers Union, at the Design and Engineers Union, who would otherwise have been bidding on this project. But these were the unions who will be inevitably in contact with this whole project. When that changes the entire transportation landscape of the city, and it's over a century in the making, that was suddenly open to me. These guys were finally talking to me, and I was able to get a wealth of information in a very short period of time that otherwise I just wouldn't have been able to get.
Now, having written this, are you giggling at what you're seeing now in the political landscape?
It would be laughable if it weren't so damn sad.
Yeah. But, I mean, you called it years before Trump even reared his head.
It wasn't about the presidential election to me, as I said in the book. I don't really think it matters which alpha vermin winds up contaminating the Oval Office. It really doesn't matter. And people make this big to-do about the state of the Supreme Court. I don't think it's even going to come down to the Supreme Courts, because what ultimately is the big prize here is Congress. See, the Supreme Court can pass all sorts of laws regulating this, that, or the other, but the Supreme Court does not write tax law. The president doesn't write tax law. Congress writes tax law. And if you have single-party government, which, after all, in a democracy, a history of democracy such as ours, is somewhat toxic to the process. The country was founded on a plurality, on multiple opinions informing each other. You have single-party government steamrolls over that. And if you cast your mind back in recent memory to the year 2010, think of what the 111th United States Congress, to which my second book, The Big Dogs, is dedicated. They're the PDJ at the back of disease jackals. Just to name three pieces of legislation that were rammed down the throats of the American people in 2010 alone, between February and November, when the supermajority was effectively lost and we regained mixed government, you had ARRA, ACA, and Dodd-Frank passed within the span of February to November 2010. And the three of them have one thing in common, which I think can be summed up in what I call the no-end spend. Just think about the stimulus package, which was passed in February 2010, which was initially penned at $787 billion, that's billion dollars. Later revised in 2012 or 2013 by the Congressional Budget Office to $831 billion. Except that CBO report kicked out the horizon, the ending point of the stimulus, to 2019, which means the spend can't really be calculated because it hasn't stopped yet. The spend is ongoing. It's the never-ending spend. And when you have other pieces of legislation, ACA is now doing swimmingly well across the board, where you have whole insurers abandoning whole regional markets. You have state exchanges collapsing under their own weight. You have Medicaid rolls down, actually, when adjusted statistically, instead of the great inflated numbers that were supposed to be happening. And then you have Dodd-Frank, where even as recently as I think it was August, when Lawrence Summers, one of the president's hand-picked team of economic advisors just starting out, and a big proponent of Dodd-Frank, actually said live on national television on CNBC, banks are actually less safe with all the regulations we put in place. What's that say to you? I'll tell you what it says to me. It is a staggering lack of responsibility where you actually put this in place. You threw it out onto an entire industry, a pillar of the American economy, and then when you saw it didn't work, you just walked away. And you don't even take responsibility for the failure of the policy.
What were the forces that put it into place? They just...
Think of it as massive, massive backlash, mass hysteria, and stoked by populism, which has been directed at a financial industry which is by no means innocent and certainly committed all sorts of excesses, Wells Fargo just being recent example. But Wells Fargo is just one domestic example that is being sought after and being a target of what I call Shakedown Nation. Shakedown Nation is essentially a kind of, in the abstract, a massive government squeeze of the financial industry, not just the domestic, the global financial industry, for its own personal ATM. Think of all the fines levied against JP Morgan, HSBC. Think of what think of the hot seat that Deutsche Bank is now sitting right. on. $14 billion fine, somehow magically revised down to $5.1 billion, which just happened to be, according to some of their internal reports, the amount that the bank had set aside for litigation. Just that exact amount. Know what it reminded me of? It reminded me of back in 2011, right after Apple had announced that it had $60 billion in cash. Right after that, in 2012, the Department of Justice announced a lawsuit of Apple
right.
over price collusion, price fixing of e-books. Right after they announced they had a $60 billion cash hoard and they weren't sure what to do with it. That is the MO of Shakedown Nation. And the financial industry, and again, I repeat, in all fairness, the financial industry is not innocent, not wholly innocent. But the financial industry is being made not more than just a piñata and a whipping post for all sorts of massive government, crisscrossed and hysterical government legislation and open-ended spending policies. It's being used as an ATM. It is a shakedown. It is because, where do these fines go? When somebody sues Chase J.P. Morgan, and Chase J.P. Morgan settles with the Department of Justice or the Treasury Department, where do those monies go?
I don't know. And that's set up by design, do you think? Or do you think they just stumbled into this?
I don't know that they stumbled into it. I think that in the wake of near economic collapse, it was a sort of every man for himself attitude. And every man for himself becomes multiplied exponentially when you have single party government, as you did in the year 2010.
Right.
And when you have a palpable, tangible hysteria in the air, a massive backlash against the financial industry, which was seen as being the cause of all of this, the cause of the collapse of the real estate market, the cause of the collapse of the cause of the credit crisis, the cause of the collapse of Bear Stearns and Merrill Lynch, the sudden spike in unemployment, burning the global economy down, blame the banks, kick the banks. It's all their fault. And it's very easy, I think, for people in power to mobilize a distracted, distraught, and suffering population. And the population was suffering. I remember those days in 2008, 2009, when I was writing my first book, Rivers of Gold. I can remember the most common sight, and I actually put it in Rivers of Gold. The most common sight that I remember seeing walking around the city was people just sitting on their hands and knees with holding their heads in their hands, crying, just out in plain sight in the public because their world had just collapsed and they didn't know what to do about it. And when you have people who are that injured, that broken, those people become your infantry if you are looking to stir up popular opinion to get your own agenda passed.
And when you consider about 80% of the people are willfully ignorant, it's very easy to put the shiny objects in front of the monkeys.
I don't know that I can generalize about... I don't know that everybody is willfully ignorant. I do know that economic extremes in any place, any time in history, economic extremes always, always breed social extremes first and political extremes right after that. Think about Germany in the 1930s. Hell, think about Western Europe in the 1930s.
Right. Are you familiar with Bill Hicks?
No.
He was a comedian in the 80s and very political and just talking about the single government that at the end of the big inauguration day for whoever is the new president, at the end of the day, you're brought into a little room in the White House. Lights go out, screen comes down, and you watch the Kennedy assassination from the grassy knoll. And the screen comes back up, lights go on, and they say, "Now, do you have any questions? You'll find your agenda on the table as you leave." It just seems like that to me at this point.
Well, again, I don't know that...
Or am I just too conspiratorial and believe that there's no hope?
No, I think that you are experiencing a lot of the sort of the malaise and the kind of the fatigue that has no real positive outlet or channel other than Blind Rage at this point. And that's a fatigue of, we are just finishing up the 8-year run. How different are we right now from where we were, let's say, at the end of 2008? What progress has been made after all the acts, all the legislation, all the political upheaval, all the turnover, all the staffing, and all the never-ending spend? What has that accomplished?
It doesn't appear as a whole lot to me.
Well, is it not a whole lot or not a whole lot of positives?
I think probably both.
Maybe you're not alone in that opinion.
Oh, I'm very sure I'm not alone in that opinion. I think that's part of what we're seeing in the politics now. It's just rage against the machine.
It's not in the politics, but the people underneath it. Because again, I think populism has been used as a political weapon now for so long that it is the only knee-jerk outlet anymore. That right up to the contenders who are vying for the throne. And again, I really do not think that whoever contaminates the Oval Office next is really what it comes down to. What it comes down to is who controls Congress, who controls the purse strings, who will, or do we get more of the never-ending spend? Do we get more knee-jerk hysterical legislation? If you want to know what's in it, you got to read it. Do we get more acts that almost 7 years on, haven't actually... They're still writing. They haven't finished them yet. Do we get more of that form of business as usual? Or do we go back to what we had before, which was also a source of great popular frustration, which then fed populism, which is gridlock. And gridlock meaning nothing happens. Gridlock, it must be said, has its pros and cons. The biggest con is nothing gets done. The biggest pro is that nothing gets done as is, as in the case of, I should say, that you can't ram hysterical legislation through Congress, and do it in recess, by the way. You can't do that and get away with it if you do have gridlock. Now, again, it's a very uncomfortable yin-yang having gridlock, but gridlock is also what mixed government is. Mixed government, if you can get past the gridlock, mixed government is the so-called reach across the aisle, where you actually have people, let's say in Congress, both houses, both chambers, both sides of the aisle, actually saying, you know what, let's compromise. Let's actually do the business of the people that we were sent here to Washington to do, so that maybe we can go back to our home districts and not be pelted, you know, by angry mobs. And will gridlock be a sign of better times to come? I don't know. But I do think that single-party government, looking back to recent history, you don't have to go any further than 2010 to see what single-party government can and has achieved. And will we go that route again?
Now, this has been pretty heavy. I want to stress to everybody, these books are exciting. Very exciting. Lots of action, lots of information you are not aware of, and sex. How did you research all the sex stuff? No, I just threw that in there because you throw sex in and people will go for it too.
Suffice it to say, I get asked this question a lot. Adam, are the female characters in your books real? Of course they are. All of them. I'm not very creative. And the sexual aspects of the books are there to add, hopefully, a layer of realism. Sex is still a major driving force in society, as you don't have to look any farther than the presidential election to see that.
Yes, it is.
But it's there because people, men, women, they're going to interact at a sexual level at some point in their lifetime. That is as close to an inevitable, as close to a given generalization that you can make about Homo sapiens in the 21st century as I think you're likely to get away with. It's going to happen. And when you have 20 million of those people living in a pressure cooker hub metropolis like New York City, it happens a lot.
Yeah, but you don't make it gratuitous. It's everything that has to be there at the time that it needs to be there. And again, I really love these books. And as I was reading and going through the you know, underground and the bank behind the soup kitchen. And I'm going, I had visions in my head of just exactly how this would look. And then I said, so you're doing a movie? Are you doing a TV show? Or do you even want to talk about that right now?
I started a production company, Aurelian Productions, earlier this year. Aurelian Productions is the film and television arm of my publishing imprint, Dunn Books. And we are in pre-production of an episodic TV series now based on books published by Dunn Books. More will be on screen in 2017.
And then you're working on a new book.
I'm working on the next book in the Moore series, but also Dunn Books is bringing out its first titles published by others. People have always looked at Dunn Books as being some sort of vanity press exercise. Not anymore. We have our first hardcover novel, Osiris, by Eric C. Anderson, which is coming out in fall of 2017.
Why do I know that name?
Osiris, I mentioned once before. Osiris is...
Eric C. Anderson.
Because I mentioned him here the last time I was here. Okay. He was one of my technical readers, my first ones. And he was the one who came up with a very simple question that has now spawned our first spinoff series. What does Moore do when he's out of town? Read Osiris and find out. We have another series that we're launching, which I think you will very much enjoy, and I hope to talk with you more about. It's called the Fractus series. The Fractus series is a short fiction anthology about the collapse of the current world order arranged by region. The first title that we're bringing out, also fall 2017, is called Europa Fractus, and it is about the end of the European project, the end of the world order that basically started August 1945 and for all intents and purposes ended in November 2008. And we're still seeing the knock-on effects from that, and it's done, again, by region, not by union, but by region. So it was inspired, the inciting incident for this was the Brexit vote.
Right.
And what I do is I commission authors from countries in this region to come up with a short story based between the present and 10 years out on how they see the end of this order taking place. And the first edition, Europa Fractus, will be out fall 2017.
You're a busy man.
Better than being bored.
Then I'll say. I just, you've created your own publishing company because?
I saw what I thought to be a train going off the track. And I saw this beginning with the property crash in 2007 and veering into the financial crisis the following year. And then the governmental response, and when I say government, I don't mean just our own, I mean global government response to it, which I spent a lot of time talking with my father, who was dying. He saw this in 2008. He passed away in 2013, and I spent a lot of his final years talking with him about it. And he used to rant about the sort of direction that he saw us going. My father was born in the Great Depression, and he served in World War II.
Greatest and, generation.
And he could not believe what he saw as the raw thievery and incompetent thievery that he saw going on at the highest levels of governments around the world and the mass psychosis of the populations going along with it. And if he were around now, just to take one instance, I really wonder just what he would say, if he could say anything, at the prospect, the reality of over $13 trillion of negative yield debt being held by largely sovereign governments through their central banks. $13 trillion plus of basically guaranteed losses. They are paying to take losses. Can you even conceive of what $13 trillion looks like? I can't.
No.
I have this image in my head of soiled, dirty, blood and cocaine-stained greenbacks stretching from here to the surface of the moon. That's 13-plus trillion dollars in negative yield debt. And this is the best that we can do? This is the best that governments around the world have come up with? This is the train that's jumped the track. It's gone through the dividing line. It's off the bridge. Dad, where are you now? I wish you could see this. I mean, I really wonder what you would have to say about it. I think it would be a lot of, shall we say, choice language involved.
So what is the answer? Or does one even exist?
One thing which I would caution against. People ask me which way I'm going to vote, and I'm not here to tell you that. It's not my place. I will say this. Populism as a political weapon always leads to a bad end. We're seeing it now, and believe me, if you think it's bad now, it can get much, much worse. Read my novel, Saint Underground. You'll see much worse it can get. And be wary. Do not vote with hot blood. Vote with a cool head. Be wary of any cause, anyone who is trying to come at you through the guise of empowering you, doing you a favor, moving you along. To the effect that we'll get you better doing this way. That is a new orthodoxy dressed up as it's an old orthodoxy, just in a new guise. It's the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove. It's meet the new boss, same as the old boss, happening all over again. When you're standing in line on November 9th?
8th.
8th, thank you. And you have people who are coming up to you and telling you about this, that, or the other thing. Here's what I say to do. Call a cop. That's what they're there for. tell them to brush these guys back to the minimum required distance.
Yeah.
Because that's the law. Nobody's supposed to tell you which way to vote. That's one of the things that makes the U.S. not Pakistan. And it's one of the ways that a century and a half ago, de Tocqueville called the American experiment. That American experiment is not dead. It's still ongoing. Let's not blow it. And don't blow it because your blood's up. Keep a cool head. And if somebody is going to be slinging some snake oil at you, try to see through it and see it for what it is. Ask yourself what this will actually do or do not. How does this benefit me? Is this really the best course of action? Think it through. Don't just knee-jerk respond to it.
That is such a good idea, but I'm astounded by the stupidity that I see around me in America today. It's frightening.
So get beyond it by hopefully, first of all, turn the volume down on all the noise. Try to separate the wheat from the chaff.
That would be
my choice. Read a book. Write a book while you're at it.
Yeah.
Please do. And really try, because a nice thing about writing is a brain exercise. Actually organizing your thoughts lets you articulate them better. You get your message through clearer. Your thoughts are clearer. You are honing your mental machine when you have to actually arrange your thoughts on paper. Use a screen. That's fine. But actually take the time to think it through. And don't be reflexive. It is what I think we have here is, we live at a time when the pace of life is vastly accelerated, where we have come to live our lives and make decisions which used to take a lot of very careful thought and timing and planning. We're used to doing it now with the click of a button. We're used to doing it with the swipe of a card. And life has not evolved on this planet at that pace. And human thought, as fast as it may happen, as quick as an idea may come to us, when you have ideas, and particularly ideas that evolve into legislation that are going to affect millions of people, when you have these things that are not thought out from inception to potential consequences, that's plural, consequences, what are the outcomes, A, B, C, D? What's your plan B, C, D, F, if these things happen? When you have that kind of accelerated, knee-jerk, reflexive, instantaneous mode of life that is applied to everything and multiplied exponentially when you have it concentrated in the hands of a few in government whose decisions will reverberate across with millions and millions of their subjects.
Subjects.
You have the potential for disaster.
Subjects.
Yes. No pun intended.
Okay.
That you have the potential for seriously catastrophic damage that can be felt across thousands of people. The austerity that, millions of Europeans have been feeling for the past several years is real. And it has been so bad that even, here's a telling sign, back in, I think it was 2011, when Greece was hovering around collapse, you know what happened? Barter broke out. You had the replacement of an ages-old money economy dating back to at least the Periclean age in Greece. You suddenly had that reverting to something that is much older and much more fundamental. I'll give you my milk cow for 20 gallons of gas, or the use of your rifle and a couple of extra clips, or my daughter for the weekend. You have that reversion because you have a massive turning away, a massive distrust of or disgust with established institutional norms. You have people who no longer trust banks enough to actually go and do their business or do anything involving any kind of financial transaction with any legitimate, regulated, overseen, monitored financial institution. You'd rather do it from a storefront or a hole in the ground where nobody can see what you're doing.
Right.
Because you don't trust the machine that was set up in place, because the machine has proven itself broken too many times for your liking. And so what happens when people, they see frameworks, organizations, they see existing machinery of society that can no longer do its job? What do? They turn away from it. They take matters into their own hands. They start doing their banking in a hole in the ground. They start bartering out in the hillsides. They turn away from paper money, from traditional or legal means of exchange, and turn to other means, stuff that is far out of any kind of government oversight, stuff that cannot be regulated, and stuff which, once it gets going, picks up steam awfully fast. Does anybody have a size of the shadow banking economy, a ballpark figure of how big it is in America, in China, in India, in Russia? There is no firm figure on something that, by definition, isn't regulated. Nobody knows the size of it, and nobody knows the velocity of it, the scale of it. They can only get a sense of what happens when there's either a big bust, there have been two in China in the past couple of weeks, and what happens when those people who are still holding on to any kind of means, whether it's money, whether it's hard assets, when they try to pick up and leave, or when they start hoarding stuff. Remember that Chinese general a couple of years ago?
Right.
Has castle raided, and they found, was it 4,000 pounds of gold amongst all of these various other treasures? This is a government official living like a warlord. Where do you get that? Well, if you have, and this is something I wrote about in my second book, The Big Dogs, when you have too much government regulation squeezing not just industry, but also the people, the actual persons who make up and populate these industries, when they see government as not there to help or to guide them, but is to take from them, when they see Shakedown Nation coming their way, what are they going to do? They're going to try to hide whatever it is that they have. And the first way to do that is you get it offshore, you try to transfer it through, well, fast transfer systems like the one IMDb case that is breaking nowadays. You try to move it through a bank in Panama. You try to, the list goes on. I mean, it is a litany of woe that is part of the knock-on effect from a lot of the hysterical knee-jerk legislation that stemmed from the crash of 08. And it's going to continue into 2017 and 2018 when the new Basel regulations kick in. And I think it is 2018, on banks around the world, telling them to raise even more capital and imposing even more regulations on them, stuff that they're already reeling under after Dodd-Frank, after 7.5 years of Dodd-Frank. And when the thumbscrews get so tight that the banks can no longer get on with the business of banking, which after all is lending money to people so they can start businesses or send their kids to school or take care of their ailing parents or keep roofs over their heads or food on the table, what happens then? Well, as I write about, you hand over control of that great global ocean of capital. You just hand it over part and parcel to the criminal element, to people who don't bother with rules, to people who could care less about regulations, and whose only point of contact with any kind of government is when they do business with it. that what you want to see your kids grow up in? My kids are 3 and 7.
Oh, mine's much older. Yeah, I'm not worried about him. He'll probably be with the bankers. This has been absolutely fascinating. It was supposed to be a half hour up to 40 minutes.
My apologies.
No, please, no. You're a brilliant man, and I just enjoy talking to you no end. I look forward to all of your new endeavors, and as you put your TV show together, if you need some sort of a bum on the street or someone to, please give me a call.
I sure will.
Adam Dunn, thank you so much. And again, Saint Underground, Big Dogs, River of Gold. You will do yourself a favor if you read these, because you will learn things you have never even thought about and find out how it truly does affect you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.